I wasn't actually covering so much the sex abuse cases as covering the efforts of the bishops in the United States to respond from the late 80s to the middle 90s or so to the cases that had made this, you know, no longer a problem that could be considered just anomalous rotten apples, but a deeper and perhaps more systematic problem. So I did cover a lot of the bishop's efforts, which were not successful, which were uneven, which were not obligatory until the revelations of 2002, when finally they established a national uniform obligatory policy for dealing with questions of sexual abuse. And you should realize that the United States has almost 200 different dioceses, counting those in the Latin Rite and in non-Latin jurisdictions. So it's very hard for them to all get on the same page at the same time.
And I suppose often, even though, you know, later when people were looking at it, they could see that it was happening across the church. But if you were a bishop dealing with a handful of cases, you might have had the impression that you were just dealing with a handful of cases.
One of the challenges that anyone looking at this as a historian will have in the future is dealing with this question of the gaps in time between much of the abuse and the readiness of victims to bring these things to light. So that by 1985, between 1950 and 1985, we now know that there were probably as many as 11,000 plausible allegations of abuse. There were only 810 of those recorded in diocese things. Now, if you remember again that there were, let's say, roughly 180 dioceses over a 35-year period, of course, they weren't all evenly distributed. But if you just think of that way, it's very easy that any given bishop would have seen, you know, only a handful of these cases and not recognize that there was something more serious going on that demanded a more systematic response than just individual treatments of various priests.
And for a large part, they didn't really treat the priest. I mean, it was a case of maybe telling them not to do it again and then moving them on. There wasn't that sense or even that understanding that people needed extensive treatment.
In the United States, it's very important to see this in a series of stages or phases. There's certainly, up until the 1980s, well into the 80s, that was the tendency to say this was a spiritual problem and make a retreat and do better and so on. But by the middle of the 1980s, it was recognized that that wouldn't do. And so there was an extended period where various bishops, and they did this in different ways, it's hard to generalize, sent people into either individual therapy, or they were sent to treatment centers, many of which were specializing in sexual misconduct. So there was, and there's a very big debate about whether that therapy was good, whether the bishops were paying attention to what the treatment centers told them, whether the treatment centers were telling the bishops what the treatment centers thought the bishops wanted to know. It was a complicated problem, and that's something that we still really need to explore seriously.
Mm-hmm. And, I mean, you're looking at the aspect of using the media as a source for the history of Catholic sex abuse, and, I mean, a lot of people have reservations about the media because they feel like they're looking for the controversial story, they're looking for the sensational story, and that maybe the nuances of it aren't always portrayed.
I asked myself two questions. One was the coverage, again, I'm speaking of the United States, largely affected by anti-Catholicism, and my brief answer is no, although anti-Catholicism exists below the surface in American culture. My second question was, Were the media reports, generally speaking, accurate? And my answer is yes. Though, of course, any future historian will have to distinguish between serious publications and reporting and tabloid journalism, whether in print or on TV. Nonetheless, I think the problems of looking at the media and the problems that the media itself faced in reporting this issue are more complicated than that.
I think for a lot of people, the real disappointment was the cover-up. I mean, people were obviously appalled at the abuse and appalled at what had happened, but I think they really felt that their trust was let down by the institution. I mean, if they could have just thought, yes, it was that small number of predators, you're going to get that in every society. But here were people, like an institution, covering it up in a way that people maybe hadn't seen happen before.
Well, in the United States, the situation was that in a lot of dioceses, there were efforts, for example, to review all the allegations in archdiocesan records and then to remove people from ministry who were found to have committed this kind of crime. But at the same time, there's the question of whether you make everything public. And this has been, when one uses the word cover-up, I think there are two things you're thinking. One is of a priest who is still in active service, and has that priest, who is a threat to children anyway, has been adequately dealt with. And all this is usually private. For example, someone is removed from one parish and switched to another, but the parishioners never get any explanation of it. Another way in which that word is used is, should you make public all the names of all the priests, living or dead, who have been credibly abused over a long period, many decades? And there is a case that you should, because victims who thought they were isolated and the only ones have the chance to come forward and deal with this. On the other hand, these are cases that have never been adjudicated in any way. You don't know really if they're what the truth of the matter is. So it's a very complicated problem, and that has gone on in the United States. Let me add something that's very important. We have found that there was a real increase in clerical sexual abuse from the middle 1960s until the middle 1980s, peaking in the late 70s and early 80s, and really sharply decreasing. This isn't just because the people who have been abused more recently haven't brought their accusations forward. It really is the new accusations confirm this pattern that there was a growth, increase, and decline. So that has posed a particular problem about how much you're going to go into the past and make public. And all I can say is it is complicated, and it isn't easily solved by the reporting in the news media.
What was there a sense of trial by media? Because as you say, a lot of these cases didn't go to a criminal court. So it was never really, as you say, adjudicated on. So a lot of these allegations remained allegations.
I think that there's good evidence that the great majority, at least in the United States, of allegations have real credibility. They are not people simply trying to get compensation. It is true that there is a convergence in the news media's coverage of this with the lawsuits for damages, and that the victims' lawyers have a responsibility to present their case as best they can. The historian's responsibility is somewhat different. And the historian's responsibility is to look at the institution and its failures in many different dimensions and to not make this a case of simple villains and simple victims.